Till now we have talked about episodic and semantic memory, which are basically part of the declarative memory. It's also called as explicit memory. Let us now come to the implicit side of the memory, what is called as procedural memory. Procedural memory basically constitutes the knowledge of the procedure and the skilled behavior. So when we acquire a skill and gradually we realize that the whole process that we have learned for a particular type of an operation becomes too automated, okay, and we have developed a control, we have developed a mastery over the process, okay, that is called procedural memory. Now, declarative memory, from that point of view, if you see, they are basically what of the facts, okay, and the events, whereas procedural memory, it basically denotes how of the procedure, and therefore procedural memory is usually implicit in nature. You must have seen many events in your life where you perform the task and you remember the full mechanism as to how to operate it. Say for example, cycling, riding a bike, okay, running a computer, okay, whole of these mechanisms you would realize that there are steps, a series of steps, no, and all these steps has to be religiously followed in sequence if you want the mechanism to work appropriately, okay. But then it is now so nicely acquired by you that these intermediate steps, the transition between the steps, none of these things you remember, no? You realize as if things are getting done automatically. This is called procedural memory. Let us look at this very video to see how a medical technician actually performs a task meticulously, although he knows what the apparatus is, he knows what the concerned doctor has asked this technician to perform. Rest all involves whole degree of movement of knobs, fixing the machine, taking out the output of the machine. Okay, have a look at this.
ये second knob है, ठीक है? ये MA है knob, ये KV knob है. ये selection button है. ये first knob है. First में routine work होते, X-ray करते हैं. Second knob है. सेकेंड में फ्लोरोस्कोपी है एंड थर्ड नॉब में बकी एक्सरेज है एंड फोर्थ नॉब वर्टिकल बकी है.
Now that we have understood the explicit and the implicit side of the memory, let us now look at another aspect of long-term memory, what is called as prospective memory. Prospective, something which is about to come. So if a person fails to remember what he or she was going to do, so say for instance, I intend to go and switch on the light, I leave my table, go towards the switchboard, and halfway if I forget what I thought, that is loss of prospective memory. No? So the inability to remember the intended action, okay, is what is called as prospective memory. Older people usually they show this problem of prospective memory. In our young days, adulthood, usually we do not have this type of a problem unless we are too busy and we are into multitasking, then it might happen because of competition between two thoughts which are going parallelly. Else, even in the case of at least older people, even if they have one single thought, one single prospective step that they had planned to execute, there might be a problem in terms of inability to recollect what he or she was intending to go and do. So this very image represents now what actually retrospective and prospective side of memory would be. Now, retrospective memory, if you think that today I submitted documents to the bank, you have already performed the task and you remember. Okay. Prospective memory would be I plan to. Okay. And you have planned something, what exactly you planned, okay, halfway while trying to execute it, you forget it. That is the loss of prospective memory. It is mostly seen in elderly people. Having now understood sensory short term and long term memory, let us once try to compare between these three systems of memory. We will try to compare these three structures of memory on certain criteria. So, on this screen, when you see in the white font, the word written there is the criteria on which the three memory systems are being compared. So, first let us compare memory system in terms of their approximate duration. Sensory memory, we discussed that the duration is 1 to 2 seconds for iconic memory and 4 to 5 seconds for echoic memory. This expands substantially, it goes up to 20 to 30 seconds in the case of short term memory. And in terms of long term memory, it could be days, months, it could be even lifetime. Okay. So, something that starts from 1 second up to lifetime, this is the whole expansion, up to first 5 seconds part of sensory memory, up to 30 seconds that is short term, and thereafter it is long term. In terms of capacity, we realize that sensory memory also has a relatively large capacity in terms of storing information. And at least 16 items can be stored at the level of sensory memory. Okay. And probably little more can also be done. Short term memory from that point of view, given the time it has, okay, we realize that the capacity is relatively small. But this capacity increases manifold if the items are divided into chunks. Okay. And if depending on whether you form a chunk of 3 or you form a chunk of 4 items, approximately up to 40 items can be stored in the short term memory. Long term memory, it is very large, okay, and the limit is just not known, any and everything can be stored. Then we come to transfer in memory. Okay. In terms of transfer, we have the long term memory where transfer is not at all needed because information is already stored there and it has nothing to do beyond that. But in case of sensory memory, attention and recognition, they play an important role. Items that are attended to and items that are recognized, they have the likelihood of moving towards the short term storage. Okay. Items which you do not pay attention to and items that you fail to recognize, okay, they will not be forwarded to the short term storage. In case of short term, we did discuss this fact also, that there are two types of rehearsal, the maintenance rehearsal and the elaborative rehearsal. Now, depending on the rehearsals, the items are appropriately forwarded to the long term memory. Now, we come to the type of information that is stored. In case of sensory memory, it is exact copy of the input that is stored. In the case of short term, it can have sounds, visual, images, words and sentences. Okay. Long term memory has the fantastic thing. Long term memory primarily has the meaningful sentences, life events, concepts, images. Okay. Right now, we discuss semantic and episodic memory. So, whole of this becomes the part of long term memory. In terms of inability to recall information from long term, if you consider reasons for information loss, in sensory memory, decay of trace has been considered as the important reason why information is lost. In short term memory, it is the displacement of the old information by the incoming information. But in the case of long term memory, it could be faulty organization, it could be inappropriate retrieval strategy, or it could be interference. Okay. So, two informations, if they compete against each other to be recollected, this could lead to interference. Okay, you have given the file name memory and you search by file name emotion, you will not get the information. No? So inappropriate retrieval strategy is being used. Or if because you know that the information is stored in an organized order, you go for a random search, okay, you are not able to retrieve the information. So these could be the possible reasons of loss of information from long term storage. There are two more interesting things about memory. We will talk about one right now, the reconstructive aspect of the memory. Sir Frederick Charles Bartlett, okay, performed a very interesting experiment. What he did was that a story was narrated to a group of students titled The War of the Ghosts, okay, and then the story was supposed to be reproduced by these students who had actually heard it. What Bartlett was able to prove was that the story, when it was reproduced after passing through several mouths, underwent series of reconstructions, and almost all details related to the American Indian culture were omitted, and several others were rationalized when students tried to recollect the story, reconstruct the story. What was very also interesting was that each narrator added something to the story, okay, based on his or her own imagination. Okay, few details of the story was leveled, making it very very simpler. Some other facts were exaggerated, and therefore what happened, finally the story got changed in this entire process. Bartlett said that this is reconstructive memory. Why? Because something that you heard of, okay, and when it is transmitted from mouth to mouth, the whole episode gets reconstructed. No, several things are leveled, several things are exaggerated, several things are downplayed, and therefore the original content and the later content undergoes a big difference. One very interesting example I would like to quote from one of the Indian studies by J.P. Das and Ravindra Kanungo. They conducted very interesting study where two groups of students who belong to two dominant castes in the country, Brahmins and Kayasthas, they were given four lists of adjectives. Okay, the first list had adjectives describing Brahmins in favorable terms like nice, good looking, clean and so on. The second list had adjectives describing Brahmins in unfavorable terms like rude, greedy, fat and so on. And the same thing was done for the Kayasthas. List 3 had adjectives describing Kayasthas in favorable terms, and list 4 described them in unfavorable terms. Now, when these Brahmins and Kayastha students were supposed to recollect the content, everyone remembered more unfavorable adjectives than the favorable ones. And based on this, J.P. Das and Ravindra Kanungo, they inferred that people prefer to remember bad attributes rather than good ones. One interesting thing which is also talked about in introductory psychology is an effect called Zeigarnik effect. Bluma Zeigarnik was a Russian psychologist who actually compared memory of tasks which you are able to complete and compared it with the tasks which you are not able to. What she did was, she basically interrupted the work and did not allow the participants to finish the task. Okay, what she finally found out, and what is now called as Zeigarnik effect, is that interrupted tasks were remembered more frequently than those which you are able to complete. Okay, so things that you are not able to complete, you would remember it more. Now, this might mismatch with our daily life experiences. Another interesting study, again by Ravindra Kanungo along with Datta, they gave an interpretation to the Zeigarnik effect. They said that the intensity of the emotion that is induced by the complete or the interrupted task, that becomes a critical factor. Okay, so it is not the task per se, but the emotion that it leads to. So any activity that gives rise to a strong emotion, okay, whether it is pleasant or unpleasant, that doesn't matter. The fact that the activity gives rise to a strong emotion, such events will have a better memory. Okay, you remember right now we said, you know, in our previous lecture, that things which has an element of surprise, things which has personal significance, okay, and things which induces great degree of emotional arousal in you, those things have better chances of getting recollected. Okay, so this was the explanation given by Datta and Kanungo as to why Zeigarnik effect works. Another interesting thing that is also talked about in memory is memory construction. Bartley, he proved that there is reconstruction in memory. Construction of memory has basically to do with the experiences that was gathered in the clinical setup, where memory is implanted and therefore the participants recall events of their life which had actually not happened. Okay. Now, this depends on the suggestibility of the participant. Certain type of content is implanted into your memory, okay, and you are supposed to recollect it. So, when you recollect your life experiences, you try to recollect even those events which actually you did not experience, but you were told that this is how things had happened with you. Okay, this is called memory construction. This type of memory modification, okay, basically takes place because of the misinformation. Okay, and after experiencing an event, when individuals are exposed to new misleading information, the recollection of the actual event, it gets distorted. Okay, and this is something that sometimes is also witnessed in interrogation, what is called as suggestive interrogation. Okay, so if an officer interrogates a suspect, okay, and you deliberately ask questions which has lead answers, for example, if I ask you, were you present there in that very building at that time, that is a question which asks you to declare whether you were present or not, and you have an option of saying that fine, I was not present in that very building. Think of the other situation. When I say, so when you were in building, what actually happened at that time? You are not given the opportunity to declare that I was not available in the building. Okay, the question is based on the premise that you were actually present in the building, and then it goes beyond that, asking you what actually did you see inside the building. Okay, this is an example of suggestive interrogation. Okay, therefore, this is a misinformation. The fact that you were not present in the building is not taken into account, but then a misrepresentation allows the whole construction of the new sequence of events, and therefore it is called as constructive memory. Now, we come to what is called as memory distortion. Remember, we are still not talking about forgetting. Forgetting will be our last lecture with respect to this very topic on memory. Now, memory distortion basically is a change in the content of the recall, okay, as a result of internal or external factors. So, there could be cognitive bias. Okay. You have a bias which does not allow you to remember good things about somebody about whom you have a negative feeling. Okay. So, for example, if you do not appreciate someone, all good things told about that very individual, okay, because of your bias, you are not able to remember. Okay. Say, for example, right now we took the example of suggestive interrogation. If you go for suggestive questioning, okay, the question that I ask suggests, gives a cue to you as if what is expected out of you, what type of response should you give. This is suggestive questioning. Okay, this is bound to distort the memory. Okay, plus the schemas, how the representation of the world that you have made in your mind, the mental representation, that might be important in terms of better recollection, accurate recollection or distortion. And how motivated you are to recollect the information, that would also play an important role. So let us now talk about the methods that are predominantly used for studying the process of memory. Four important methods we would talk about today: free recall, recognition, priming, and neuroimaging. The recent phenomena that you find is the dominant usage of neuroimaging technique, wherein the brain scans are used to identify which regions of the brain are involved in the memory of what kind of information. Let us first begin with free recall. Free recall, as you can make out from the word itself, it is recall, that is a recollection of the learnt information in a free order. Okay. This means that you are free to recall the information, okay, regardless of the position of the event. You remember we had talked about the serial position effect, no? The primacy and the recency effect. So free recall basically means that you are supposed to recall the information regardless of its position. We have talked about serial position effect, the primacy and the recency effect. Now, if I give you a list of items and then tell you that you have to recollect information in the order in which it was presented to you. So say for example, if I give you a list of items that you have to procure from the market, and I say that these 15 items have to be recollected in its serial order. So first item should be recalled first, second item at the second order, third item at the third order. You would realize that usually people commit much of an error in terms of recollection, okay, and that is what is called as recall, where we have the serial position effect, where we have the primacy and the recency effect. But free recall usually is considered as one of the good methods, because you don't have to worry about the relative positioning of the information, rather you have to simply recollect the information. Now in anticipatory score, recollection in the correct order is taken into account. Okay. But free recall would basically mean that you, regardless of the position, you just recollect the information and accordingly you get a score for that. So that is one of the dominant methods in studying memory. The second important method for studying memory is recognition, and that is one of the most generously used techniques nowadays. Even for this very course, when we will come to evaluation, okay, you will come across multiple choice items, no? So when you are supposed to recognize the learnt information which is hidden among other items, okay, so you have the question written on the top and then you have four options. Only one answer is correct and rest of the three are false information. So when the actual information is hidden among us the other information, and you have to recognize that this is the correct answer, this is what I had learnt, this is called as the method of recognition. Okay. Multiple choice items is the best example of it. The third and interesting method of studying memory is priming. Now in case of priming, how acquainted you are with the stimulus, that is important. So what happens, acquaintance with a stimulus, it basically facilitates your response to the stimulus which is presented later. Now let us understand this with the help of this illustration. Now I ask you that look at your screen, and based on the sketch that you see at the bottom of the screen, identify the person. Okay, and I'm sure none of you would be able to identify the person. I add a little bit to it and I say, can you now identify the person, given that you have little more cues? Perhaps some of you might make a guess. I add little more and I say, very recently you saw one of his recent movies which had this very character. Can you now identify whom you are looking at? And now when you see half of the face, okay, you say that, oh, I know him, he is the most celebrated actor of Indian cinema, Mr. Amitabh Bachchan. Okay, this is priming technique. Okay, so what actually happens here, okay, you are acquainted with the character, okay, you were presented with part of the information, and depending on how well acquainted you are with the facial features, okay, you would have identified. First case, you would have certainly not succeeded. many of you would have succeeded just after the second slide, okay, when these little more cues were given. Some of you would have by this time, many of you would have probably identified, and after this much approximately all of you would have identified who this person is. Okay, this is called the priming technique. Now, priming is considered to be most effective when it is used in the same modality. So, if you are using visual priming, then it is good to use visual cues, and if you are using verbal priming, then it is good to use verbal cues. Okay, in that case priming will be very, very effective because you are using same modality.